We've got three panelists here, and speaking first will be Bob Rees. This is for Should the Youth of Zion Carry, and guns and churches. And Bob Rees is an all-time Sunstone person, done a lot of great things, has taught at UCLA, and now is teaching at the Graduate Theological Seminary in Berkeley, teaching Mormonism and so forth. And Rick Starr is my old friend from, well, not that old, my old friend from Graceland. He was a student back in the late 70s when I was teaching, had him in a couple of classes, and he was really, really quiet and a terrific addition to the student body. In the year that he was at Graceland, we trained for and ran the Drake Relays Marathon, and once you run a marathon, train and run a marathon together, you're buddies for life. Rick teaches criminal justice in the School of Law at the University of South Australia, and is president of the Australian and New Zealand Society of Criminology, and is a world traveler as a professional. I managed to snag him for Sunstone as he became in between a professional conference in Eastern Europe in Bulgaria, and now an international conference on criminal justice next week in Mexico. He's a member of the Standing Eye Council of the Community of Christ, and their meetings are conducted by Skype. I said that there are 12 high priests located around the world. Mitch Velos, is that right? Yeah. Mitch Velos will be commenting on the issue. He's a graduate of USU and the BYU Law School. He's been practicing law for 28 years and often serves on panels on guns. He is the head of the Utah Gun Exchange. Rick and I join with Bob Rees and assure the audience that we are not packing heat here today. Now, Mitch says that he's always carrying a concealed cell phone. we've got strict time orders, 25 minutes for the two main speakers, and then 15-minute response by Mitch. And I'm going to sit in the front row here. I've got some professionally made signs, 5 minutes, 3 minutes, 2 minutes, and time's up. And I'll flash these, and if they exceed their limit, I've got a trap door, and we've got a den of hungry lions waiting right down below. So, Bob.
Thank you, Bill. As with many subjects, the prelude to having a constructive conversation on guns is dependent on one's ability to objectively see a point of view opposite from one's own, something that's challenging for all of us, especially in the polarized world in which we currently live. I begin by identifying those aspects of the subject that I think represent common ground. For me, that begins with an acknowledgement that it is reasonable to interpret the Second Amendment as guaranteeing the right of U.S. citizens to own weapons for both hunting and self-protection. If that were all we had to agree on, I think the dialogue about guns in our society would probably be no more heated than if we were talking about cars or cell phones, two other dangerous things, by the way. Further, I acknowledge that some Latter-day Saint scriptures, as well as the words of some Latter-day prophets, can be interpreted as supporting this right, that is the Second Amendment, especially when it comes to protecting freedom, liberty, and homes. Why, then, do I think that when it comes to guns, my fellow Americans and my fellow Mormons have gone crazy? Why does it seem that any discussion of gun control appears more suited to a house of bedlam than a house of reasoned discourse? Why does it seem that defenders of our present gun culture ignore facts, logic, and reason, not to mention a significant body of scriptural and prophetic discourse that suggests there is, to use Paul's term, a more excellent way when it comes to policies and practices surrounding guns? Why do people, including many of my fellow Latter-day Saints, seem willing to sacrifice 30,000 of our fellow citizens to gun violence each year on the chance that someday they may have to stop someone from entering their home? Why does our present culture of guns defy not only reason and religion, but common sense and common goodness. I could say that the reason it seems crazy to stockpile guns and ammunition and permit guns to be carried openly, including in malls, universities, and churches, and not to have strict gun control laws, is that, in the face of the carnage that guns cause, especially to many innocent people, it is crazy. At least at times it seems to me as if some alien force has secretly infected my fellow Mormons with a virus that causes them to pay more attention to the words of Wayne LaPierre and the National Rifle Association than to the apostles and prophets, and to regard the rhetoric of the gun lobby as more sacred than scripture. That's hyperbole, of course, but not by much. However, it isn't an alien force, but it's ourselves. As Pogo would say, and I know that dates me, the allude to Pogo, we have found the enemy, and it is us. What I mean by this is that as a society, we have allowed ourselves to be seduced into believing the mythology, the nefarious government agencies and other demonic forces are conspiring to take away our guns and our liberties, and that therefore we must prepare as if for an all-out war. Spend a little time on the fringes of the blogosphere, and you'll see what I mean. For example, for several years there's been a buzz on certain websites about a supposed prophecy made by President George Albert Smith about a coming calamity for America, quote, a troublesome vision of another great and terrible war. It would include a Russian nuclear attack and an invasion. During this time, weapons would be taken from the populace, and thus, as it is reported, President Smith advised the saints to have weapons and ammo stashed. And hilarious to think the President Smith would use ammo instead of ammunition. Let's go with the flow here. And where they could not be confiscated, to stash them away where they couldn't be confiscated, but quote, which could be gotten at a moment's notice. The person reporting this prophecy advice, get some guns and ammo. Your lives, your family's protection is your responsibility. You'll remember their screams. It's no different than making sure they're baptized. It's your responsibility. It gets weirder. The prophecy apparently included the fact that, quote, the president at that time of this great invasion and the great takeover and the confiscation of guns would be of Greek extraction. Somehow, the person reporting this prophetic warning surmises that Greek is really code for black, and warns ominously of, quote, George Soros and other ultra elites creating another Oklahoma City bombing. So, all of this so that President Obama could get elected in 2012. This conspiracy is confirmed in reports by FEMA purchasing millions of body bags and hundreds of thousands of grave liners and planning, quote, a mass immunization center in Ward in Salt Lake City, as well as mass cemeteries in Southern California, Phoenix, and Houston. And if that seems illogical to you, the premise is that obviously it's a confirmation of government dysfunction that you would have the mass cemetery, a mass grave, mass morgue here, and the mass cemeteries in Phoenix, Houston, and Los Angeles. That's a good way to spend your tax dollars. St. Blog warns, if you are LDS and live in Salt Lake City, then you know the Wasatch Fall is long overdue for a slip. With the help of HARP, the government's High Frequency Active Oral Research Program, an earthquake on the Wasatch Fall, which could be obviously produced by the government, would produce in excess of a magnitude 8 earthquake. This, apparently, is in fulfillment of prophecy in the Doctrine and Covenants. Behold, vengeance cometh speedily upon the inhabitants of the earth, a day of wrath, a day of burning, a day of desolation, of weeping and mourning and lamentation. And as a whirlwind it shall come upon the face of the earth, saith the Lord, and upon my house it shall begin. Right here. And it shall go forth, saith the Lord. So this pending magnitude 8 earthquake caused by the government is one of the reasons to keep your guns locked and loaded and away from any creeping government interference. Charles Lewis, in his book 935 Lies, about how we were deceived into going to war in Iraq, says, quote, "Convictions are more dangerous enemies to the truth than our lies." If I were a playwright trying to write a 21st century drama with a theater of the absurd, I can think of no more appropriate subject than the scenario that I've just described. Whatever such a piece of theater might be, it certainly would not be a comedy. Theater of the Absurd seems an apt description of some Americans and some Mormons' intoxication with weapons of destruction. Their love affair not simply with rifles, but with handguns, shotguns, AK-47s, M-16s, Beretta AR-90s, and many other weapons that can be used to kill lots of people and do it quickly. During the Revolutionary War, a skilled soldier using a musket could fire his weapon 2 to 4 times in a minute. A modern soldier or citizen using an AK-47 can fire 600 rounds in a minute. As the poet Richard Eberhard expressed it, with such weapons, quote, "we can kill as Cain could, but with multitudinous will, no further advance than in our ancient furies." To illustrate why I think this whole gun business is so crazy, let me cite a few statistics. China, with a population of 1.34 billion people, owns 40 million guns. India, with a population of 1.19 million, has 46 million guns. The United States, with a population roughly a fourth of those two countries, has 270 million guns. In other words, almost one for every citizen. The United States ranks first among all nations in terms of gun ownership. Let that sink in while you consider that among the countries with which it is most closely allied, it has by far the highest percentage of gun deaths per 100,000 people. Or compare our murder rate with that of Israel, a country that lives under the constant threat of violence, perhaps even annihilation, significantly beyond that of the United States. What is the cost of our feeling safe by owning an unlimited number of guns and having them constantly and ubiquitously available? This is a situation that seems to me where the golden rule might inform our reason and our morals. How can we be indifferent to the massive deaths caused by our extremely permissive gun laws based on the prospect that someday we may have to use a gun to protect ourselves? Again, I'm arguing not against the right or even the necessity of defending our homes, but on our willingness to support and sustain a system that allows guns that can kill with multitudinous will. Mormons take the Lord's warning about, quote, "designs which do exist in the hearts of conspiring men and women in the last days," when it comes to tobacco and alcohol, but seems not to think it possible that such designs might also apply to guns and to violence. Thus, many Mormons support the National Rifle Association and the manufacturers of guns without ever questioning their motives or the results of their power and influence in shaping our laws regarding guns. Thus, we tend to endorse rather than counter an organization that, according to Congresswoman Carolyn B. Maloney, has, quote, "silenced and gutted all federal funding for research into the costs and causes and possible cures for gun violence, and has blocked an assault weapon ban, a limit on the size of ammunition magazines, universal background checks, and even basic research." We lament the many deaths caused by alcohol, tobacco, and drugs, yet we seem singularly indifferent to those caused by guns. Or if not indifferent, then somehow blind to their corrosive effects on our national psyche. Instead, we quote Alma, quote, "you shall defend your families even unto bloodshed." and Brigham Young that the saints, quote, have got to carry weapons with them to be ready to send their enemies to hell in cross lots, end of quote. We remember Hans Nill, Carthage, Nauvoo, Johnson's army, and hostile Indians, the time when Mormons referred to their guns as, quote, avenging angels, as if these were present-day realities. Thus, Governor Boggs has been replaced by Barack Obama, and the exterminating mobs of Missouri by the specter of jackbooted government thugs invading Mormon homes and communities with the intent of confiscating our guns and taking away our liberties. We imagine a time when groups of priesthood holders will be called to be the new Danites, and in company with the NRA, save the Constitution. The scriptures promise us that there will be refuge from the blood and terror of the world in the latter days. But it says nothing about our needing guns to protect that refuge. But the Latter-day Saints have a particular charge, in fact, to renounce violence and to proclaim peace, can be seen in the revelation given to the prophet Joseph Smith on the 7th of March, 1836. In this revelation, the Lord indicates that the Latter-day Saints are to establish, quote, a land of peace, a city of refuge, a place of safety for the saints of the Most High God, end of quote. In the last days, this will be the only place where those committed to nonviolence, those who, quote, will not take out their swords or their guns against their neighbors, can flee for safety. For these will be, quote, the only people that shall not be at war one with another. Further, the Lord suggests that this peaceful, nonviolent people will have a power much greater than arms and warfare. For the wicked will say, let us not go up to battle against Zion, for the inhabitants of Zion are terrible, wherefore we cannot stand. And they are terrible not because of their guns, but because of their spiritual power. I hope no one will be offended by my observation that for such a time and place to be realized, in Mormon culture must undergo something of a sea change in its attitude toward guns and violence. Let me close by citing a story about Constantine. This story about Constantine was told by St. Ambrose. To me, this story, whether historical or not, and it's claimed to be historical, illustrates the degree to which Mormon Christians have become intoxicated with guns at the cost of ignoring the essential message of the Prince of Peace. After Constantine had risen to power and considered converting to Christianity, his mother Helen, who was probably already a Christian, went on a pilgrimage to the Holy Land. While in Jerusalem, after searching for a long time, she found the cross on which Christ was crucified. She removed the nails from the cross and sent them to her son as an emblem of Christ's ultimate sacrifice. What did Constantine do? He melted them down and made bits for his horse. Thus Constantine rode to war with a horse's bit fashioned from the sacred nails of the cross. When it comes to guns, I think that metaphorically we have done something similar to the teachings of Jesus Christ in the latter days.
Greetings all. Thank you for coming for this session. There were some other terrific sessions on the same time, so I'm grateful, as the other speakers are, that you've chosen this one. Let me say that often people talk about dreams they've had that have brought them here. I had a dream last night that Bill Russell was driving and we were driving over a cliff. I'm working on that metaphor. I haven't thought that through.
Yeah, speaking of that too.
But speaking of Bill, I want to correct just a couple of things that you said by way of introduction. The first one is that, yes, I'm a member of the Community of Christ Standing High Council. He then said we are 12 high priests from around the world. When I was ordained or set apart to the Standing High Council just last year, I'm the first non-North American to ever be on the Standing High Council. So it would be nice to have high priests from all around the world, but it just hasn't happened until last year.
You're just under the world.
Under the world. My blood flowing to the head, as Bill often reminds me. And the other thing, too, was he said that we ran the Dragnet Relays Marathon together. Not true. He was at least a half an hour ahead of me the entire time. So, but we did have a wonderful friendship over the last 35 years. I'm delighted that he's extended this opportunity for me to address you this afternoon. I want to give you three quick scenarios, and I want you to think about what these three scenarios might have in common. And if you are at the end of them thinking, I don't know, I'm going to tell you. But let's see how we go. Let me tell you about this sort of story that you might have heard from time to time. I don't wear seatbelts. I once heard about someone who was in a car accident and they were thrown from the vehicle and, you know, landed safely near the vehicle, which then exploded into flame. And had they had that seatbelt on, they would have been burned alive. That's why I don't wear seatbelts. You've probably heard that sort of story. Story number two. Smoking. That's all right. I had Uncle Harry. My Uncle Harry smoked every day of his life. And he lived to be 105. We've all heard that, haven't we? I got nothing wrong with smoking. Okay. Story number three. You know, I heard a story the other day. There was a guy with evil intent. He was marching towards a theatre or a school. And someone just happened to have a firearm with them. And they could see this guy had evil intent with his two rifles and sort of dressed in his army fatigues, and they took him out. As a result of that, 35 people's lives were saved because he was going to take them out. Therefore, you know, we should have the right to carry a firearm because you never know when it's going to be that you're going to be intersected with someone and you can save all those lives. Can you see some common themes here? Of course there are common themes. Story number one. For every one of those stories, which might happen from time to time, when a person does get thrown away and the car is, you know, engulfed in flames, there will be tens of thousands of people whose lives and bodies have been saved by the wearing of seatbelts. So we will wear seatbelts, not because of that one person whose life was saved by them not being immolated. We will not smoke cigarettes because for every Harry, Uncle Harry or Uncle Joe, whatever I said his name was before, who lived to 105, we will save hundreds of thousands of lives by limiting people, by making it more difficult or more expensive or more unattainable for people to get hold of cigarettes. We know that. We know that because the statistics are unequivocal. And here's my little spiel this afternoon. For every one of those stories where a person may intervene in a circumstance where some other lives are saved thereby by shooting an intending assailant, we will save tens of thousands of lives by reducing the number of guns available to private citizens. Now, that's a big call because the other two are completely unequivocal. Seatbelts save lives, making smoking less attractive saves lives. Absolutely unequivocal. But where the gun control and gun advocates come to grief is about the proof in relation to whether or not limiting guns saves lives. I'm going to give you just three little illustrations of that, which I'm sure Mitch will challenge. But I'm happy with that because that's where the debate currently is. We just do not have that absolute unequivocality that we have with smoking and seatbelts. But here's my three little stories. First one comes from Australia. Australia, as you may know, has a fairly strong anti-gun culture. It arose out of an incident in 1996 when a hapless no-hoper walked into a cafe and then wandered around a tourist resort in Port Arthur in Tasmania with his two or three army-style assault weapons and killed 35 people. After that, the Prime Minister, Conservative Prime Minister, I should add, slapped a ban on the ownership of all pump-action shotguns and semi-automatics. Assault weapons were, of course, always banned, but this was pump-action and semi-automatic firearms of any description. Now, the government spent hundreds of millions of dollars buying them back. 700,000 of them were surrendered, and Australia now has a very strong regime of ensuring that guns do not form part of the Australian ethos unless you have a licence and a proper reason, such as a farmer might have a proper reason for having a firearm. And even then, you can't have a semi-automatic firearm. Now, there has been, according to the evidence, and I'm a lecturer who looks at evidence, and I'll be quoting various things. I can't obviously give the entire quotes, but just the Lee and McNeil study, 2010, has said there's been a significant decline in gun suicides since 1998, when that surrendering occurred. Chapman et al., 2006, serious and significant decline in gun-related homicides in Australia. You know, from time to time people say, well, there hasn't been a mass shooting in Australia since 1998, which is true, but that's not such a big thing since there haven't been too many mass shootings prior to that time, but there certainly hasn't been one. So the evidence starts to build up there in Australia that that experiment has been a significant one. Two, a study that I rather like, and I go back to again and again, is one that comes from fairly reputable, I would have thought, Harvard School of Public Health. A decade ago, did a study of the 5 gun law states and the 5 least or lax gun law states, and compared children and deaths in those 5 states. This was 2002, a decade-long study, basically through the 1990s, where they looked at the 7,000 American children in that decade who'd been killed by guns. So they compared the 5 states that have the highest gun control, the lowest gun ownership: Hawaii, Massachusetts, New Jersey, Delaware, and Rhode Island, against the 5 states with the highest rate of gun ownership: Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, Arkansas, and West Virginia. So here's what the Harvard School of Public Health study, decade-long study, determined. A child in the highest rate of gun ownership state is 16 times more likely to die of firearm accident, 7 times more likely to die from gun suicide, and 3 times more likely to die from gun homicide than in the other equivalent 5 lowest gun owning states. Again, Mitch and others will come up with some other studies, but I'm just telling you the evidence starts to grow that the availability, just the mere presence of guns, starts creating an environment where children are going to be far more at risk. And number 3, just a study I came across earlier this year, a chap called Van Kesteren, British Journal of Criminology. After the American Journal of Criminology and the British Journal of Criminology, the 2 most reputable criminological journals in the English-speaking world. Van Kesteren's article was entitled, quote, "Revisiting the Gun Ownership and Violence Link, a Multi-Level Analysis of Victimization Survey Data." And if I can summarize the article in one sentence, it was a multi-level analysis of 50 countries. He concluded there is a statistically significant correlation between ownership levels of handguns and victimization by gun-related contact crimes and gun-related threats, assaults, and homicides. Now, there's just 3 examples where, generally speaking, I think we can start heading a little closer towards the level of confidence we have with smoking and seatbelts in saying that the more guns you have, the more is that people are going to be dying. And in the case of the Harvard study, young children are going to be dying. Now, that's all I want to do about talking about the statistics. I want to talk about what are the ways that we can do if we start thinking policy-wise about stopping gun violence. What can we do? And I've reduced these to 4 things. I'll just tell you what the 4 are, and then I'll talk about each one of them very briefly. Number 1, we can maybe reinforce the idea of some sort of barriers, to physically stop people who are carrying firearms from going places where they shouldn't really have them. Number 2, legal changes. The gun laws that we have about licensing and stuff, and making sure that only people who can use them properly have access to them. Regulation. Number 3, detection, just kind of predicting through profiling who it is that might start engaging in rather inapt ways of using firearms and intervene in their lives before they can go ahead and use them for nefarious purposes. And number four, something about cultural change, the psyche of the people generally. So those are the four that I want to look at now and just kind of work out maybe which one of those or which combination of those are going to have the greatest effect on reducing gun violence. So physical barriers, legal changes, detection and profiling and intervention as appropriate, and number four, cultural changes. Let me begin with physical barriers. These are the sorts of things that we see at airports, for example. In fact, you can't get into a courthouse in Australia, I assume it's the same here, without going through a sort of metal detector. You take your bag out, put it on the thing, take your cell phone out, etc. Screening, random checks, just basically putting up barriers so that people can't come into universities without going through some sort of metal detector. They can't go into schools without a metal detector. They can't go into an office building without a metal detector. Yes, fairly useful, I would have thought, but massively expensive and massively difficult to implement when you consider all the places that people might want to go and the places that you might want to protect. The tens of thousands of schools across this country, the tens of thousands of churches, the tens of thousands of government departments. As an exercise, it would be virtually impossible to do within current budgets. But nevertheless, you know, there's a significant risk associated with that. They can be fairly useful. But as I said, very clumsy and very expensive. Number two, the legal regulation. How useful is that going to be in making sure that we only have the appropriate people holding these firearms? Well, the big one, of course, with the one which Australia has it is, you certainly can't get a firearm without a license. And not only is the shooter or the user licensed, but the actual firearm is licensed. There are registered counters and everything else, and so we know exactly who's got what firearm. And if the police want to come along and check to make sure that your firearm is being stored aloof from its ammunition, they can do that on a moment's notice, and the law allows them to do that. So we have strict regulatory activities, and of course, as I said before, you simply cannot own a semi-automatic or a pump-action shotgun. If you are, you are fined, etc. So those sorts of rules are there. But they are difficult to maintain. And of course, in this country, as Bob has said, there's an immediate objection, although Bill might talk a bit more about the actual interpretation of the Second Amendment, but the Supreme Court here, as my class indicated when I was taking Bill's classes back in the 70s, has traditionally allowed the Second Amendment to be interpreted in a way that makes those regulations fairly difficult. So while we have a lot of evidence that licensing can be effective in limiting the availability of some weapons in some circumstances, another study, Blazer et al. In 2011, it's going to be a fairly clumsy way of encouraging people to give up those firearms, or at least making sure that those firearms don't fall into the wrong hands. And particularly in this country, where you have the Second Amendment, which makes it far more difficult for governments to act upon that sort of mandate anyway. What about early number three? So we talked about one, barriers, two, legal regulation. Number three, what about early detection? Is there something about the study of who it is that's engaging in firearm illegal use or use for nefarious purposes? What does the evidence tell us about that? And for this, I'm going to turn to a French-Canadian scholar called Frédéric Lemaire, who's been publishing the last couple of years, who has done a massive study, a 30-year study of mass shootings. And what he's been building up is a profile of how they've unfolded and who is engaged in them with his particular team. He's out of George Washington University at the moment. I should just tell you, he looked at 114 mass shootings. He's defined mass shootings, a bit of a debate going on with the FBI. The FBI calls a mass shooting three or more deaths, not including the shooter. Frederick's been a bit more conservative about this. He's calling it four deaths, not including the shooter, because sometimes the shooter is takes his own life. I say his, I don't know, there's too many female mass shooters. Yeah. But the bottom line is, there are, in this last 30-year period, around the world, it's not just in this country, but around the world, there have been 114 incidents which he's analysed of mass shootings. 75 of them are in this country. That's two-thirds. That's 75% of the 114 mass shootings, that's four or more people dying, are in this country. So I'll come back to this country a bit later. What did he discover about the mass shooters themselves? About 43% of them had typically made some sort of threats. These days we hear about that in relation to putting things online. 56% had a record of mental illness. Now that's of course a fairly vague and difficult term, but in his work he describes how he classifies mental illness. For example, what in fact is mental illness is a difficult thing for him to define, but nevertheless, a record of some degree of mental illness, 56%. The majority are white males in their 30s and 40s living alone. Okay, 30% of them have had some military experience. Okay, 60% of them have owned two or more rifles. Okay. Well, that's good. That's interesting information. So we can sort of build something of a profile here. But a profile is one thing. Acting on that profile is something else. What do you do? Do you look at all white males in their 30s and 40s who are living alone and see if they've got two or more rifles? I should point out that he also noted that of the rifles, usually rifles, that are used in relation to these mass shootings, 75% of them were bought and owned quite legally. So you know, you kind of look around and say, well, okay, this guy's 30, he's living alone, he made a threat against his partner the other night, he served in the military, actually didn't serve in the military because only 30% of our military service. He owns two or more rifles, he once said he was suffering from a psychological problem. Do you go and lock him up? Do you put a 24-hour watch on him? What do you do? I mean, it's one thing to have this sort of profile, but it's something else to kind of act upon. In fact, it's almost impossible to act upon. So let's see how we're going so far with our four ways of stopping gun violence. One, the barriers are improbable and far limited and, of course, very expensive. Two, regulation very difficult, particularly in this country with the Second Amendment. And third, trying to do profiling and detection, massively hit and miss, and it would be a massive breach of civil liberties to start watching every person who started filling this particular profile. So what's number four? And number four is the one I want to focus on for the moment, and I've got about 5 minutes to go. And that is to look at whether or not there can be a change in our cultural and political and religious will. And that's where the church has come in. And that's where I think we can take this particular debate a little further in this sort of environment. Because I firmly believe that that's the only place where there can be a change of hearts and minds. And maybe not in our generation or the generations who are older than us, but in the coming younger generations. Challenging the individualism that lies behind the myth of the power of the gun to protect our freedom. We all know freedom has limits. There's a wonderful phrase that I don't know the name of the Supreme Court Justice. Bill might remind me, it was one of those sort of Rehnquist or one of those famous guys from the last half a dozen decades, who said, "My right to swing my fist ends at the point your nose begins." So our limit to swing our fists has limitations if it starts impinging upon the rights of others not to have their nose broken by my fist. And that's where the answer is, I think, in relation to our guns. It's wonderful to say, I'll get the freedom, Second Amendment, to hold this particular gun. But when the evidence starts stacking up that the mere presence of those guns is going to make the society in which we live a far more dangerous place, that freedom starts to need to be constrained. My right or liberty to own a gun ends at the point where it becomes clearer and clearer that the collective is endangered thereby. And that's where I think the church has a role to play, pushing the rights of the collective up against the rights of the individual. Now, theologically, that's a debate I suppose we could have. Haven't we been pushing theologically the idea of everyone's own kind of personal salvation and personal dialogue with the deity, or the collective? I suppose that's kind of where the churches can kind of maybe have a debate around that. I'm firmly of the belief that we live in our theological quest in community. We don't necessarily live in our theological quest on our own, and particularly if in protecting that right to have that individualism, the collective starts to be endangered thereby. So I'm of the view that the churches must take a more championing and active role to push the particular mantra that sacred space is disarmed space. And I'm going to finish just by telling you, I better get my folder here.
You've got 5 minutes.
Okay. I took this off the church website this morning just to refresh my memory. Back in 2000, so 14 years ago, we had a resolution from Australia that went to the World Church in independence, and we were able to pass this particular resolution. I should say the vote was fairly close, but here's what the World Church resolution says now for the community of Christ. In 2000, there were a whole bunch of whereases, you know, Prince of Peace, etc., etc., sort of things that Bob were talking about, and down to this nub of the resolution, that the Church, one, encourage in its members a thoughtful and reflective stewardship regarding the use of firearms for professional or for sports purposes. Can you see there was a little bit of give and take there? And two, the Church encourage its members to renounce the personal use of firearms for all other purposes, as a response to the call to recognise the worth of all persons. So that's now church policy within the community of Christ, a thoughtful and reflective stewardship if you are using firearms for professional or sports purposes, and for all other purposes, to renounce the personal use of firearms as a response to the call to recognise the worth of all persons. Now that hasn't stopped the community of Christ from failing to act in relation to various things that are happening in this country about the relaxation of the personal carriage of firearms. And just recently, you might know, one of the southern states passed a law saying you could actually carry firearms into various buildings, presumably schools, supermarkets, other places, except not legislatures. There's a bit of a contradiction there, that the legislators seem to think that was going to be endangering their lives. But nevertheless, that's a freeing up. There's a phrase they use here, it's sort of the freedom, freeing up stuff that's coming out of legislatures at the moment. Somehow or other, the gun control was not allowing us to have our freedom to carry. So we now have a lot more freedom to carry laws coming in, and they seem to be kind of on a bit of a march from the south up towards the north of this country. So I finish just by telling you what it is that Australia will pass. How do I know that? Because I know Australians. We will pass this next year, and it'll come to our World Conference the following year. I'm just going to kind of put it out to you. I read it to Bill this morning. I dictated it to myself on the plane yesterday. This is what it's going to sound like. Whereas our enduring principles and ambition initiatives call us to be peacemakers, whereas the World Church Resolution, etc., one I just read to you, says what it says, and whereas some legislatures worldwide have either placed no restrictions or have lifted prohibitions upon private citizens carrying firearms in public places, and whereas some legislatures worldwide now place no restrictions on firearms being carried into public buildings, including churches, be it resolved that the Church in Australia, one, affirm the principle that sacred space is disarmed space and thereby prohibit the presence of firearms on any church property, and two, lift up this principle for the consideration of the World Church at the next World Conference. And if you'd like to be there for that in a couple of years' time, I'm sure you'll find it to be a wonderful debate. Thank you for coming along to this session. I look forward to hearing our bitch speak and then having a short discussion thereafter. Thank you once again, Bill, for the invitation.
Well, now I wonder if this will work.
Just lift it back up again. It should come.
Okay.
Yeah, well, not until you utter your first word.
I mean, look, 50 minutes of anti-gun presentation versus I get 15, I kind of feel like the Alamo, you know. Hoping that this wouldn't end up being some sort of a debate on statistics, because you can take statistics and you can just about do anything you want with statistics. The problem with the statistics about the 30,000 deaths in the United States is that you take the negative side of gun ownership, and you never consider the positive side. It'd be like filing a tax return and only declaring your expenses and not declaring your income. Because while there's 30,000 deaths a year in the United States from firearms, half of those are suicides. About another third of those are gang and drug related. And if you look at the murder rate rather than the homicide, see, a homicide could be anything. A homicide could be a police officer shooting a bad guy. And that's counted in the homicide rates, okay? And if you only count, there's a straw man that people that debate against gun rights use. It's called gun homicides. If you only look at the gun homicides and ignore the knife homicides and the stranglings and the bombs and the whatever else, that comprise the murder rate, which is really the bad homicides. I mean, people defend themselves regularly in the United States with firearms, and attackers, violent felons, are killed. And those violent felons are included in the homicide rate, the gun homicide rate. You look at Massachusetts, Mayor Bloomberg included the Boston bomber, who was killed by the police as a victim of gun violence. So you can do all kinds of things with statistics, but if you ignore the 2.5, well, let's say 100,000 or 400,000 to 2.5 defensive uses of a gun a year versus 30,000 deaths, most of those are gang and drug related and suicides, then you get a false picture of the benefits of gun ownership, and it's a skewed picture. I mean, there's about 8,000 murders a year in the United States. Most of those were with pistols. If you look at assault rifles, there were 323 deaths total with rifles in 1 year, according to FBI statistics, and that included the Sandy Hook shootings. And so not all of those were assault rifles. So the use of assault rifles in murders, the incidence is almost statistically insignificant. Now, so I didn't want to get into... let me also say this. It's interesting that Brother Reese talks about policy and guns, but in his own state of California, they have a murder rate of 2.7 times that of Utah. In Utah, we have very, very lax gun laws. All our teachers have the right to carry guns in schools. They've had the right since 2001. All state employees have the right to carry on the job in buildings in Utah since 2001, including the legislature. There has not been one state employee, not one teacher, not one student injured as a result of teachers and state employees carrying guns in school since that HR policy was changed back in 2001. This is a nice place to live, and we're awash with guns. Availability of guns was the issue, then Switzerland, where just about everybody has a gun, would be the murder capital of the world, and it's not. It's got one of the lowest murder rates in the world. If gun laws were the answer, strict gun laws, Mexico, which prohibits the private ownership of guns, would be the safest place in the world. And it's got a homicide rate of about 5 or 10 times in the United States. And most of the gun murders in the United States are committed in the states like Chicago or Illinois, or Chicago, where the gun laws are very strict. And then you look at Vermont that has very few gun laws, where anybody that's not a criminal can carry a gun, concealed or otherwise, in Vermont, and it's got the lowest murder rate in the country year after year. So I don't want to get off on that, but and John Locke found, he was a criminologist from the University of Chicago who set out to prove that gun ownership was a negative thing, found that more guns mean less crimes. The counties that have the highest incidence of gun ownership have the lowest murder rates and violent crime rates. So let's not get onto statistics, because statistics, if you want to argue statistics, the right to keep and bear arms wins hands down every time. Let's just show something. Let's show reality for once here. See what's really happening. If I can get this off. I didn't know I was supposed to get what these two brethren were going to talk about in advance, and I had no idea. I never did get that. And so I took the title of the presentation literally. It says, "Shall the youth of Zion falter?"
Carry.
So they crossed out the falter. Remember, it's a hymn. "Shall the youth of Zion falter?" No. "Shall the youth of Zion carry?" I guess the song says no. Who are the youth? Ages 12 through 17, right? And I guess they shouldn't have the right to carry. And I thought, well, how do you defend that as a trial lawyer? I mean, how are you going to tell people at a conference that young people ages 12 through 17 should be able to carry guns? That's a loser. It's there's no way to defend that. But that struck a chord, and I thought, well, let's see what's actually happening. Now we have cameras everywhere. We have video cameras. We have local news stations reporting on what's going on in the country. A lot of this never, ever hits the national press. And so I thought, well, let's check the internet, see what's going on there. Let's see what I found. Okay. Let's just look at a couple of things.
15-year-old at home with his 12-year-old sister when burglars try to break in.
That's when investigators said the boy grabbed his dad's assault rifle and started shooting, and he hit one of the men repeatedly. This all unfolded this afternoon in the 2600 block of Royal Place Court. 11 News reporter Sherman Chow talked with neighbors and investigators.
Anxious family and friends cross videotape into a surreal crime scene. A 15-year-old boy and his 12-year-old sister had been home alone in the Mount Royal Village subdivision. Then about 2:30, a pair of home invaders tried the front and back doors, then broke a back window.
A young boy was protecting his sister. He was in fear for his life and for his sister's life.
The brother grabbed his father's assault rifle and knew what to do with it. His dad is a Precinct 1 deputy constable.
We don't try to hide things from our children in law enforcement.
The children were not hurt. The home invaders fled, leaving a trail of blood. Two suspects showed up at Tomball Hospital. One, the adult, had multiple gunshot wounds and was flown to Memorial Women's Hospital. The second, a juvenile, was taken back here. Detectives...
Our friend from Australia advocating no personal use of firearms. Okay, you got a 15-year-old and his sister at home, and you have a violent criminal breaking into the house. And this young man, age 15, who's had a few lessons with firearms, and a lot of these people that I could show you if I had the time have never touched a gun before and act very appropriately in defending themselves and others. And he defends his sister. Now, would the Lord want this violent criminal to break in and rape the 12-year-old sister? Do you think that's what Heavenly Father wants? It didn't happen because of the right to keep and bear arms in the United States.
Let's go to the next one. Yeah.
Oh, it's called Cruise.
explosion that ended with one person shot. Jill Monnier just spoke with investigators. She joins us live from the scene. What's going on, Jill?
Carrie, investigators say a 14-year-old boy shot a suspect who was trying to break into his house. Let me step out of the way here for you so you can see the scene behind me. At the 5500 block of Minton, near Baseline, the Levine area here in Phoenix, police say a 14-year-old was inside his house with his siblings, ages 12, 8, and 10. When they heard a knock on the door, he looked outside, saw a woman he didn't recognize. He went back about his business and later heard the door rattling and banging like somebody was trying to get inside. He went upstairs where he got a handgun, and police say as he was coming down the stairs, the door broke open. At that time, he saw a male suspect with a weapon pointed towards him, and he shot that suspect, who was taken to the hospital in extremely critical condition. Police don't believe that any other shots were fired.
So you got a 14-year-old boy. He's coming down the stairs. He's home alone. A violent criminal breaks in. He's got a gun. When he points the gun at this young man, fortunately, he had the opportunity to go into his dad's bedroom and get his father's gun, and he acts quickly and shoots the violent criminal. Would the Lord want something different, a different outcome than that? Would you want a different outcome than that? It's interesting, you know, when we talk about the prophets. Joseph Smith, I don't know if you knew this, but and I can show you the historical account. He had an assault rifle at that time. It was a repeating revolver when he was in Carthage. And when the shooting started and his brother was shot in the eye and died, Joseph got up with his six-shooter, which was an unusual gun. Hiram had a single shot. And Joseph fired six times. It only shot three times. The historical account says he hit three people. He shot the last man in the face. Okay. And in fact, there's a quote in his personal journal that says that if a man refuses to defend himself and his family, he's a bastard and a coward. I take that at face value. When the Lord was with Peter just before the crucifixion, and the crucifiers came up to the Savior, and Peter drew his sword and cut the ear off of the servant of one of the leaders, Jesus didn't tell Peter to get rid of the sword. I'm assuming he was the Lord. He knew that Peter had the sword. He was carrying a personal weapon on him. It was an assault rifle at that time. A sword was a very efficient weapon. He didn't tell Peter after that. He didn't say, Peter, get rid of the weapon. He said, sheath the weapon. Sheath your sword. He didn't tell him to go down to the Israel bazaar and sell the sword back in a sword buyback program put on by government officials at the time. Look at some more.
This kind of story that makes you say, yes, a trio of would-be burglars picked the wrong Albuquerque house to break into. Police say when the three teens pried open the door, a brave little girl was waiting for them, locked and loaded. Here's News 13's Maria Medina.
I was holding it like this. And like that.
11-year-old Alyssa Gutierrez took matters into her own hands yesterday when three burglars broke into her home.
I was planning if they came right now.
She didn't actually shoot them. They saw the gun and he ran away. Would the Lord want a different result? If she were your daughter, would you be cheering? Or would you would have hoped that she didn't have a gun to defend herself? No personal use of weapons. That's what our Australian friend is advocating. I'll tell you, it's wrong. It's wrong, and it doesn't work here in the United States. The most peaceful places in the United States are places where people have the right to keep and bear arms, like the Utah schools, and like Utah, as a matter of fact. And like my neighborhood, where just about all my neighbors have a rifle or a pistol.
Want to rely on the was police. From New York's police commissioner Raymond Kelly. He says that All nine of those innocent bystanders who were hit by, who were hit and injured during yesterday's shooting, he confirmed, were in fact wounded by police gunfire.
Police surveillance video captures the shooting in front of the Empire State Building. 58-year-old Jeffrey Johnson appears to pull a gun when confronted by two police officers. Police fire. Johnson goes down.
After nine innocent people are shot. So the question is, shall the youth of Zion carry? The point is, here in Utah, some people call it Zion, the youth are already carrying. And they're darn good looking. They're as good looking as the guns they're carrying. And we're going to continue doing that. I don't know if you read the news. I've got the letter here. 28 out of 29 Utah sheriffs, after the Sandy Hook shooting, which was a gun-free zone, incidentally, where a lot of these shootings occur. The theater shooting in Colorado, gun-free zone. He picked a gun-free zone where there was a sign that says no weapons. He shipped six other theaters within a 6 mile radius that did not have a sign that said gun-free zone. Why did he go to the gun-free zone? Think about that one. The post office is a gun-free zone. People have been going postal in the post office for 30 years. And so the post office continues its policy of restricting its employees from having any means of self-defense for the past 30 years, doing the same thing over and over and over and expecting different results. Some people call that insanity.
This gun violence, I'm sick of it.
Chuck, you ever think about getting your own gun?
No.
For self-defense?
No, I hate guns. Guns are the problem, Ken.
Sound familiar? Are you concerned about gun violence, but are convinced that having your own gun isn't the solution? Well, now there's a better one to protect your home, your loved ones, even your own business. It's called the Gun-Free Zone. Here's how it works. You don't have to be a lawyer to start your own Gun-Free Zone. For a small shipping and handling charge, plus a one-time registration fee, we'll send you everything you need to start your own gun-free zones. Remember, the paperwork only takes a few minutes to fill out. If you're an entrepreneur, you can turn your small business into a gun-free zone.
Give me the money, old man!
Fuck your kids!
Come on, give me the money!
Look!
Gun-free zone! Damn it.
You can create gun-free zones anywhere you want, even outdoors.
Give me all your money, or I'll blow your stinking head up, you little troll. Come on! Gun-free zone!
Best of all, turn your home into a gun-free zone. You'll never have to worry about gun violence again. Now that's security.
Give me all your money, you old beer, I swear. My bad. Just believe it.
To find out how you can turn your home, business, place of worship, or kids' school into a gun-free zone, call this number today. You'll sleep a lot better.
Gun-free zone. It's time to stop the madness.
Thank you very much, Mitch. Okay, well, a lot of good ideas put out here. Well, I thought maybe Bob fled. No, he's here. He's here.
Okay.
Everybody came in with a gun.
So now, the lights back on, Bill.
What's that?
I think the lights back on.
Yeah, lights back on. The No,
they're okay. We don't need them over here.
It's been unequivocally established legally that the students here at the university that have concealed weapons permits have a right to carry. We probably have people here at this conference, probably many, that have firearms, and you're not going to see any injuries.
Yeah, but should a university that's dedicated to the free exchange of ideas be carrying guns? Should they be carrying guns on the university?
Okay, should they be gun-free zones? Does that make sense?
Let's get the discussion started in a more of the typical formal way. Let's see, let's have one mic down here, and then one mic here at this end. I'm going to turn the wrong way. I think you're
a roving mic.
I think you're going to turn around. If you have a... I'll tell you what, if you have a comment or a question, I'll bring the mic back to you, but if you're too far back, just come forward. Either way. Or maybe just come forward, that's what you say.
I am a scoutmaster, retired. Uh-huh. I've worked in the scouting program off and on most of my life. One of the merit badges for scouting is learning how to use a rifle or a shotgun. I have in my pocket, it's not a weapon, I teach Sunday school. If there were an individual that was going to disturb my Sunday school class with a weapon, I could shine this in his eyes and temporarily blind him. Or I could be a liar and indicate that this LED is attached to a pistol. Luckily, we have the right to carry a pistol, even in church. I'm thankful that the sheriffs in my ward might have a concealed weapon.
And any time, if you want to respond, keep your responses short. About
I'm going to go back to something that Mitch said. Mitch was critical of statistics, but it seems to me that the thing that's less reliable than statistics are a bunch of anecdotes of individual experiences that one might string together or use individually, which are, all liars, all statisticians liars, should only. Liars or statisticians. It seems to me that ultimately one has to rely on certain kinds of things to frame what would hopefully be a reasonable discourse. And part of what I was lamenting in my remarks was that it's almost impossible, it seems to me, for people to have a rational discourse on this subject, partly because of the very kinds of appeals to emotion, the kinds of use of extreme examples. And I think that to not incorporate the fact that we have 10 times as many people killed by guns in the United States than died in 9/11. Those 3,000 deaths in 9/11 caused us to go to extreme measures for over 10 years to try and deal of that violence against our country, but we create 10 times that violence against our own citizens every year. However one wants to play with that figure, it is real. There are 30,000 people dead because of that. And you look at the 62 children who die in the United States every year because they pick up a loaded weapon that their parents have left in the house and use it without knowing what they're doing and kill themselves or somebody else. And I'm kind of shocked that Mitch discounts the 30,000 deaths, discounts those that are by suicide. My gosh, how many people would not commit suicide if there weren't an easy gun handy to do so? I find that the statistics, Utah is supposed to rank among the top states in the nation, certainly among the top five, in suicide deaths among young men 18 to 27. That to me is, you can put that against all the other things you talk about, which are perhaps available here. I think it's also it's extremely illogical to compare California and Utah on the number of scores, because you have so many demographic and other kinds of conditions that obtain that can't really allow you to make a fair comparison. But for every one of those kids who maybe picked up a gun and kept a burglar or a bad guy out of the way, you have to include the Sandy Hook and the other children. And I come down to what I was saying before, which is that it seems to me, in terms of the ethic which should govern Christian Latter-day Saints, it is the golden rule. And if it's my child, and the chances of my child being killed, or my grandchild, or my wife, are much greater because of the proliferation of guns and the influence of the pro-gun lobby, then I'm, you know, I come down on the other side.
Okay.
Yeah, why does Switzerland, you know, where there's a gun in every home, not just a gun, it's a machine gun, and why is their murder rate so many times lower than most other
countries? Can I answer that?
Sure.
I was on a mission in Switzerland.
So was I.
Okay. They're all trained. They're all military. They're all soldiers. Now, if everybody was trained, but they have one of the highest rates of death in Europe, statistically. And I can
this
prove
is true.
That. But they still, they're trained. And when I was there in 1951, they took hand grenades home. And the little kids were blowing each other up in the backyard. And they figured, well, maybe we better give up on the hand grenades. So you don't take a hand grenade home in Switzerland. The reason you didn't use statistics and you went anecdotal was the gun control people have all the statistics, well, the vast majority of statistics in their favor.
They don't. That's what I'm telling you. You can't ignore the benefits of gun ownership. 400,000 to 2 million lives saved a year without a shot being fired.
And that is a phony statistic, and you know it. It's from a college professor who just ad-libbed it.
Yeah.
Okay, just want to ask this question. I mean, that's a projection. That's not a statistic. There's a huge difference. What is the need for arms in Utah if it's so safe?
It's safe because of the arms.
Okay, Rick's turn.
Let me just respond maybe to that first discussion or the first question about the Scouts. Maybe that's the issue. I come back to this question about culture. I lived in the United States for about 4 years, so I kind of get some feel for the culture here. I can assure you, I was in the Scouts. I love the Scouts for about 5 or 6 years. There is no badge in the Australian Scouts for learning to have a weapon or a firearm. If there's a scouting badge in the United States, it tells you something about the culture of Americans. I'm sorry to say that. I'm absolutely flabbergasted if that is the case. It would never have occurred to any of my scoutmasters that was an appropriate badge to have. So there's a bit of a cultural lament. And let me just take up one little issue that comes back to Mitch, and I think it's just been picked up in the question from the gentleman in the front here. If we are talking anecdotes, and this comes back to Bob as well, I am around in a law school people who do a lot of work in relation to domestic violence, and they will reinforce in my mind that the mere presence of a gun in those homes doesn't just lead to young kids picking them up, playing with them, shooting each other. It just simply means every time there's a domestic violence incident, the mere fact of the gun, which suddenly is produced to kind of, you know, reinforce the bloke's domination of that situation, it suddenly goes off, and the potential for that particular domestic violence situation to have a fatality is that much greater. So all of my domestic violence advocates or fighting against domestic violence advocates are at the forefront of those people who say, get the guns out of the home, because they simply make what otherwise is going to be a fairly nasty push and shove into a finality where some person dies, and in 99% of the case, that's the woman.
Yeah, we have 10 women, on average, 10 women die of gun violence in domestic violence cases in Iowa, and we're a pretty small state. Next speaker, from next question, you have Linda. This is Linda Newell, author of the premier book on Emma.
I would like to just speak to what you were saying about the open carry laws in Utah. The LDS Church has forbidden guns on the BYU campus, in any church, any of their churches, or in any church building, or at any church meetings. And yet, they have not backed the rest of the state, the rest of the states, the University of Utah, Utah State, all the universities. None of them want guns on campus. My husband had a 40-year career at the University of Utah, and I can't imagine sitting in a class knowing that there was someone there with a gun. And I could go on forever about all the mistakes you can make with the open carry. Like the guys that walk into Target and with fatigues on and open carry. I mean, who would not be frightened out of their mind to see anyone? And I was in the legislature lobbying the day that a man and his young son, I don't know what, I can't remember how old you have to be to open carry, but the kid had a pistol on strapped on him going into the legislature. His dad had an AK-47, and they walked into a hearing room with these and sat there and then got up and strutted around. And this is bizarre, and I just don't see how you can support open carry. I really do not. That's all I have to say.
Okay, first of all, the churches are not gun-free zones. The churches allow law enforcement officers to carry guns in church settings. Church security has firearms. I'm sure the prophet is, we've got anecdotal...
That isn't the issue. The issue is members of the church carrying guns into the church, and the church does not allow that.
Not law enforcement people.
Well, it's houses of worship. I wrote the book on Utah gun law, and they are allowed in the genealogical library. They're allowed in cultural halls. They're allowed in, it's just not the house of worship.
The genealogical library is where the dead are, so it's okay.
Well, there's a lot of living people doing work for the dead.
Just kidding.
And as far as the legislature, nobody was at risk. I mean, over half the legislature is armed at all times. I helped certify many of them. It's not unusual to see people with guns in the western states. You go to Arizona, if you're from California, and you see somebody at a gas station and you see somebody carrying a gun in a holster, you call 911 and you report it. They'll tell you, what's he doing with the gun? And you say, it's in his holster and it's scaring me. And they say, are you from California? And they say, well, this is not a crime in Arizona or Wyoming. And so we carry guns here regularly. You don't break into houses in Panguitch or Snowville. If you did, it would be the end of you. You do that in Washington, D.C., where people have restricted rights, chances are you can do whatever you want with a homeowner. In Great Britain, homeowners are being prosecuted for defending themselves with firearms against violent criminals. I don't think that's what we want here. It won't happen here. It won't happen in this generation, and it won't happen in the next generation.
Okay.
I think part of the impossibility. While I said at the beginning that I thought it was reasonable to, in terms of the interpretation of the Second Amendment, my own honest feeling is that there is no one of the framers of the Constitution who would countenance the interpretation of the Second Amendment as it exists in this country today. I think they would be horrified that we are
The law, which was meant to protect us against foreign invaders, essentially, has been used to kill so many of us. And Mitch, I'm sorry, but if you say, would the Lord want this girl raped? Would the Lord want this house broken into? You know, that leads us to an enormous question about what God wants, but I think that we have to be careful arguing that God would want anyone to be killed, anyone to be, you know, whether they're the innocent victim or whether they're not. And so I just think it's just disingenuous to pose the rhetorical question, would God want this particular thing in this particular instance? Christ is the Prince of Peace. His whole life was peaceful. He had the power to resist the people who carried weapons against him and used them against him. He didn't do that. And I think, again, what he expects us as the peaceable followers is to do everything we can to prevent unnecessary deaths and to preserve a culture in which people feel free of the kind of fear and intimidation that so often is the result of what seems to be the proliferation of guns in our culture. We can differ on this, but I think we need to be careful about invoking what God would want.
Wait a minute, Rick, you want to say anything? And then if you want to mention.
Oh, I'll just say the United States has about 5% of the world's population. It has 75% of the world's mass shootings. Would God want that? I mean, it's it. I'm agreeing with Bob. It's not arrangement.
You want to do anything, or do I want to wait for you?
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Okay,
go ahead.
I just kind of wanted to say a little bit how disappointed I was in the response. And part of that is because we sat here for, was it 15 minutes, and you just tried to make us all afraid. It was like all of these, look how horrible the world is. You should be afraid. You should carry a gun. And, you know, I think it would have been, given the setting, it would have made more sense to talk about the reasons behind the Second Amendment, things like that. I think that would have been a better argument. So I was very disappointed. And the other thing I was very disappointed in was the way you twisted our Lord's words. You left out the fact that he said to Peter, those that live by the sword die by the sword. And I take that as a condemnation. And as far as all the fear tactics go, the other thing the Lord said was, fear not. I've lived in some pretty rough places and never had any problems, and I don't have a gun. And I can walk out tomorrow or this afternoon and get shot by somebody, and I don't have a gun. But I just thought I'd use that anecdotally since, you know, Alexis statistics.
Well,
that's kind of pro-choice. You don't have to carry a gun. I carry a gun. I don't fear either. You know, I carry a gun in here. No one died today.
Good. As a chairperson outside, I'm pleased about that.
And we're very peaceable. You pray for peace. You prepare. To defend yourself. And like Joseph Smith said, if you don't have the propensity to defend yourself and your family, well, I don't repeat the words, but, you know, I mean, we know what he said. And the Savior did. He didn't tell Peter to get rid of the sword. You know, I'm sure he was talking about people that use a sword unrighteously. But if you use a sword in self-defense, I've never seen anyone condemn that. I mean, look at the Book of Mormon, Bob. I mean, the whole Book of Mormon's about the Nephites defending themselves against Gadianite robbers, against unrighteous Lamanites, about the Lamanites defending themselves against unrighteous Nephites. I mean, it goes on and on. You got Captain Moroni. These are great warriors. They were men of God.
Don't forget the anti-Nephite.
Well, and they were... They were the ones that needed protection from other Nephites, and the Nephites were glad to do it.
Okay, let's move on. This will be Ken at the mic here.
I think if you look at our history, American history, objectively, you'll see that we are a very violent nation. And we always try to settle our disputes with violence so many times. Another thing is, there are so many people isolated and don't have any community at all in our country. And that's what's causing it. It's a lack of community, a lack of feeling for the other person. That's just my comment.
Okay. Maybe just the next question from the audience, unless there's something you don't have to, you guys don't have to respond all the time. Sometimes just the next person can step up and go ahead and
respond. Perhaps while we're waiting on that, let me just respond to that. I do think we need to revisit this theological premise, which is certainly born very much in the Book of Mormon, of redemptive violence. That somehow or other there's kind of a blood atonement, redemption. You clear away things that need to be done by having some sort of violent response as part of a redemptive thing. Now, there's no doubt at all that the scriptures are somewhat inconsistent on that. I'd like a broader theological debate about whether or not redemptive violence should not just be scourged from our current theological premise.
Okay. So let's let more people talk.
I just wanted to clarify one thing. I know what the Utah
closer to the mic.
I know what the Utah law is about open carry. The church has prohibited guns on the BYU on any of their campuses, in any of their buildings, at any of their meetings. And I understand what you're saying about law enforcement too. But even they don't. They have forbidden even concealed weapons. Okay, on their property. And I will say here that I will work hard to see that they will support the rest of the state in allowing us that same privilege to be able to worship and to walk and be educated and to walk the streets without the fear of guns.
Go ahead.
Make we got 20,000.
Make it brief though.
Gun laws on the books. Criminals don't obey the laws. You think that you're safe because there is laws against carrying guns? They don't. I mean, the 30,000 deaths, it's either suicide or somebody using a gun to murder someone. Murder's unlawful. You think they're going to worry about a gun control law or a gun-free zone sign if they're ready to murder somebody? And I'll tell you another thing about domestic violence. I've done a big study on my book has a chapter.
Sure, tell us about Clark Abishi. Abishi, excuse me.
And Clark is innocent. And he's probably spent over $150,000 in attorney's fees defending himself so he could
carry on his
employment. But he was totally innocent. The judge found him innocent. And I see that judges, if we want to do something about domestic violence, honestly, if you want to just stop drinking the Kool-Aid and doing something touchy-feely, what you'll do is you'll tell a woman to get a bulletproof vest, you'll give her a revolver and a certificate to a gun safety class, and you'll tell her that the protective order that she's received from the courts will not protect her. The police can't get there in time. And that's why we have women dying from domestic violence, because society has trained them to rely on the police, to rely on the government, and that doesn't work.
I think Rick was wanting to say, and then we'll get to him. Was okay? Were you going to say something, Rick?
No.
Okay, well, then you go ahead. Okay, Bob. Bob and then...
just a question. Do we really want to live in that kind of world?
We live in that kind of world. It's a jungle.
Okay. I'm on the board of Utah Gun Violence Prevention Center. And we have been one of the most unsuccessful organizations because year after year, the gun lobby, which is paid off by foreign gun manufacturers and domestic manufacturers, and that's where the money comes from. But this is a cultural problem. Boy, I agree with that 100%. And I'll tell you, the Catholic Church is with us 100%. The Episcopalian Church, a lot of your mainline Protestant churches have taken a stand on gun violence. And the Mormon Church stands by itself. It's silent. And that silence is damning our community.
We need to bring this to an end. But I would like to, Rick Saar, who came the furthest for this, to give any final comments.
Well, I get the last.
And then,
last
then I'm going. Then, as a chair, I'm going to be the last comment.
Oh, okay.
But a very brief one.
But my last word will be just 15 seconds worth. A lot of this debate is all premised on the idea, and certainly Mitch's idea is premised on the fact that there are very bad people in society, and there's the rest of us. And unfortunately, it's not that. There's no clear dividing line between the bad guys and the good guys. There's a lot of good guys that will do some very bad things, and there's a lot of bad guys that do some very good things as well. So a bifurcation of society that we all suddenly have weapons and the good will prevail over the bad is a pipe dream. The only way we can do it is to reduce our reliance on the idea of a firearm protecting us and making us all safer. The statistics and all the anecdotal evidence is in the opposite direction.
Okay, I want to just close on a personal note. It's anecdotal, but anyway, I live in one of the smallest counties in Iowa, 8,000 people. In a very short period of time, we had two cases where kids 10, 12, 14 years old accidentally shot each other playing with daddy's gun. And one of those was the state patrolman. Their family were close friends of mine, and they lost the son's friend. And there is two such cases, very short period of time. Anyway, finally, my personal anecdote. I've often stayed at Levina's house at Sunstone, and one year I came out in the middle of the night on a red-eye flight, and she mailed me the key, but she and Paul were up at the cabin, so I was going to have the house to myself. Levina forgot to tell Paul's parents that I would be coming in. As I came in at 3:30 in the morning, they had some stuff, I won't say junk, but stuff that were close to the door, and I hit something, and some things fell down and made a noise. Well, Paul's father upstairs was awakened, and his mom, and I heard, what's going on? Anyway, I heard them stirring. Dad was calling the police and sent Mom downstairs to check on it. But anyway, I had to really hustle to say, I'm Levina and Paul's friends. I stay here for Sunstone. And, you know, if Paul's mom or dad were gun-toting folks, I might be dead. And it would be Levina's fault because she did not tell Paul's parents. So thank you for coming.
Glad to stay with you.